Thursday, then sunny, highs in the mid-60s to low 70s. We continue with All Things Considered on KAXE.
It's not for sale, won't be for sale. Ever.
On a visit to the Oval Office, Canada's new Prime Minister drew a hard line on President Trump's talk of making Canada the 51st state.
Other than that, it was a mostly friendly visit.
For Tuesday, May 6th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, a Cinderella story of the small Baltimore paper that won the biggest prize in journalism.
Never in my wildest dreams did I think that we would be here less than 3 years old winning a Pulitzer.
Later, we'll look at why oil prices are at a four-year low.
And an author asks, what if we admit that some parents don't love raising children?
I had actually been basing my decisions about whether or not to mother on kind of half-truths.
Plus, we'll visit the homeland of a people in Syria who hold reincarnation as a central belief.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. India's military says it's targeted multiple sites inside Pakistan in a dramatic escalation of the tensions between the two nuclear-armed rivals. The Indian Armed Forces say they were hitting terrorist infrastructure from where terrorist attacks against India have been planned and directed. Pakistani security officials say there have been civilian casualties. Tensions have been on the rise between India and Pakistan since April 22nd, when gunmen killed at least 26 tourists and injured a dozen others in an Indian-administered part of Kashmir. India accused Pakistan of having a connection to the attack. A second federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from invoking the Alien Enemies Act to deport certain non-citizens. This time, the order comes from Judge Alvin Hellerstein in the Southern District of New York. More from NPR's Jasmine Garst.
Back in March, President Trump proclaimed the Alien Enemies Act, a wartime law from 1798, to quickly remove Venezuelan migrants accused of being gang members. Judge Hellerstein, a Clinton appointee, said the administration failed to demonstrate the existence of a war or invasion, so invoking the Alien Enemies Act is not valid. Last week, a Trump appointee, Judge Fernando Rodriguez, blocked officials from using the act in southern Texas. Last month, the Supreme Court allowed removals under the act, but said migrants are entitled to the opportunity to challenge accusations made against them. In response, challenges have been filed in districts across the country. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Travelers lacking a real ID will be able to fly for now, but those lacking the official star or flag in a corner of their driver's license should be ready for extra scrutiny. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem told lawmakers today 81% of travelers already have IDs that comply with real ID requirements. Passports and tribal identification also qualify. With the deadline hitting tomorrow, Noem says those people without an ID that complies with real ID could be diverted. Commerce Department is reporting a widening of the nation's trade gap. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the changes due largely to imports from companies trying to beat the Trump administration's tariffs.
The nation's trade deficit jumped to a record high, topping $140 billion in March, a 14% increase from the previous month. Imports jumped nearly 4.5% as businesses and consumers raced to stock up on foreign goods before worldwide tariffs took effect. Exports were also up during the month, but just barely. The rush of international trade is expected to slow now that President Trump has imposed the highest import taxes since at least the 1930s. Policymakers at the Federal Reserve will be weighing the fallout from the president's trade war as they begin a two-day meeting here in Washington. The central bank will announce its decision on interest rates at the conclusion of that meeting. They're expected to hold steady. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 389 points today. You're listening to NPR. Rescue crews in Texas using search dogs and drones with thermal imaging technology confirmed they've now recovered the body of a 10-year-old girl swept away by rapidly rising floodwaters. Forecasters, meanwhile, warning more heavy rains could be on the way for the Houston area. After being scaled back overnight due to rain, four swift water rescue boats resumed the search today. Forecasters say the next round of storms could bring up to 6 inches of rain to parts of southeastern Texas. About 30 pro-Palestinian protesters could be facing trespassing and disorderly conduct charges after taking over a building at the University of Washington. Member station KUOW in Seattle, Natalie Newcomb reports.
The university is condemning what it calls an illegal occupation after protesters took over an engineering building for about 6 hours last night. The building was partially sponsored by the Boeing company. Organizers of the protest are demanding that the university cut ties with Boeing over the company's military contracts with the Israeli military. The University of Washington is under federal investigation over its handling of alleged anti-Semitic discrimination and harassment after demonstrators camped out on the campus last year. For NPR News, I'm Natalie Newcomb. In Seattle.
The Senate has confirmed President Trump's pick to run the Social Security Administration by a 53-47 vote. Frank Bisignano, a Trump donor and former CEO of payment technology company Fiserv, will lead the federal agency that runs programs providing retirement, survivor, and disability benefits, as well as supplemental income for the very poor. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
It's 5:06. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. There are free day camps in June for girls ages 14 through 17 who are interested in learning trades like carpentry, welding, and electric with hands-on learning and local industry tours. Camps are located in Grand Rapids, Hibbing, and Virginia. For full details, visit minnesotanorth.edu/events. Our lows tonight, 42 to 48, and sunny tomorrow, highs in the 60s.
News. This is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. During Canada's recent election, there was a lot of attention on President Trump. That's because of his recent statements about making Canada the 51st state, and then there are those steep tariffs on Canadian exports. So today, eyes were on the Oval Office, where the winner of last week's race, Prime Minister Mark Carney, met with Trump. NPR's Deepa Shivaram joins us from the White House. Hi, Deepa.
Hey, Ari.
So this was Trump and Carney's first face-to-face meeting. What was it like?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of a bit surprising because this meeting was mostly amicable. The two leaders were complimentary of each other. It was overall a much more respectful approach from Trump. You know, you might recall how he's called the former Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau Governor Trudeau, and those two had like a rougher relationship, right? But with Carney, Trump insisted that it was a friendly conversation, and it was unlike another meeting he had in the Oval.
This is very friendly. This is not going to be like we had another little blow up with somebody else. That was a much different. This is a very friendly conversation.
He seemed there to be referring to that meeting with Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky that ended with Zelensky abruptly leaving the White House.
Right, but Carney had made Trump a centerpiece of his campaign, rallying Canadians against tariffs, against the threat of annexation. So what was he like in the room?
Yeah, Carney, for his part, called Trump a, quote, transformational president and said there was an opportunity to work together. But with this specific topic of the U.S. annexing Canada, he was very firm and direct that Canada is not for sale and that becoming a U.S. state would never happen.
As you know from real estate, there are some places that are never for sale.
That's true.
We're sitting in one right now, you know, Buckingham Palace, that you visited as well.
That's true.
Having met with the owners of Canada over the course of the campaign last several months, it's not for sale, won't be for sale ever.
You can hear Trump in the background there agreeing with Carney's points, but he still didn't back down from this idea. He said never say never on the issue and that he's done things before that people thought weren't doable. But Trump said he wouldn't bring it up in the meeting unless other people wanted to talk about it, and he said it takes two to tango.
But he has raised this idea repeatedly. Trump keeps talking about it.
He does, right? Trump has been really insistent on this idea for a while now that the U.S. should basically annex Canada, and he has said he wouldn't try to do it by force. But again, this is not only a sovereign nation we're talking about, this is the U.S.'s closest ally that Trump has expressed an interest in governing. And today, Trump said that the border between the two countries is an artificial line and that Canadians would pay lower taxes if they were a part of the U.S.
Well, what about tariffs? Any sign of a deal there?
So no sign of that happening today. And, you know, Carney said days ago that a deal probably wasn't going to happen today, so that isn't surprising. But even in the Oval Office, Trump was asked if there was anything Carney could say to him that would change his his mind about tariffs on Canadian goods. And Trump flatly said no, because he said the U.S. just doesn't need cars or steel from Canada, and that the U.S. can make those products on its own. So at this point, it's hard to see where and how things will shift. And, you know, I'll say in the meantime, tariffs between the U.S. and Canada are really detrimental for both sides of the border.
In Trump's first term, he signed a trade deal with Canada and Mexico called the USMCA. What is happening with that, given these tariffs?
Yeah, so that agreement is up for a review next year, but Trump said today he wasn't sure if the USMCA was necessary anymore. And Carney, for his part, said the way that Trump has imposed these recent tariffs on Canada was skirting the rules of that free trade agreement. So he says that's why it needs to change. So once again, at this point, conversation seems to be ongoing.
White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Indian military says it has struck several targets in Pakistan and the disputed Kashmir region, the latest in a decades-long contest between the two nuclear-armed countries that now threatens to expand into another round of serious military escalations. To discuss the latest, we're joined now by journalist Willem Marx. Hi, Willem.
Hey, Asa.
So what do we know so far about what has happened tonight?
Well, in the past few hours, India's launched what it's calling Operation Sindoor. It's a series of missile strikes it says have targeted 9 separate locations across Pakistan and Pakistani-administered Kashmir. It says the strikes were conducted without entering Pakistani airspace. They weren't targeting Pakistani military facilities, but instead were looking at locations that the Indian Armed Forces said were used to plan and direct what they call terrorist attacks against India. Now, Pakistani media is reporting comments from the Pakistani military in which they've said the strikes have left several civilians dead and injured, with damage to infrastructure that's led to a power blackout in the major city inside Pakistani-administered Kashmir, that's Muzaffarabad.
Okay, wow. Okay, well, tell us more about the explanation from India for launching these strikes.
Well, it's justified them as a necessary retaliation after an attack last month near a tourist town called Pahalgam, that's inside Indian-administered Kashmir. There we had a handful of Muslim gunmen killing more than 24 tourists, the majority of which were Hindus. India quickly accused Pakistan of supporting the group that at least initially had claimed responsibility for the attack, and it expelled Pakistani diplomats, it closed the two countries' borders. Pakistan rejected these accusations. It responded by closing its own airspace, restricting cross-border trade, prompting India to do pretty much the same thing. In social media postings, India's military have said that justice has been served with these missile strikes and pointedly talked them up as a form of revenge for what it called the barbaric attack in Pahalgam.
And what has been the response from Pakistan to these latest strikes? And are there concerns about a wider conflict at this point?
Yeah, so Pakistan's prime minister said on social media the country has, quote, every right to respond forcefully to this act of war imposed by India, and a forceful response is being given. The country's military said it's activated its defense systems to prevent any Indian aircraft from entering Pakistani airspace. It also seems, based on social media posts from the Indian Army at least, that Pakistan's restarted its own artillery strikes into Indian-administered parts of Kashmir. President Trump, just a few moments ago, was actually asked by reporters for his response to this latest round of violence.
No, it's a shame. We just heard about it just as we were walking in the doors of the Oval. Just heard about it. I guess people knew something was going to happen based on a little bit of the past. They've been fighting for a long time. You know, they've been fighting for many, many decades and centuries, actually, if you really think about it. No, I just hope it ends very quickly.
But Elsa, with, you know, Pakistanis calling India's attack cowardly, rejecting Indian claims that it targeted terrorist camps, and with Pakistan's defense minister now going on national TV to say that women and children had been killed, it doesn't seem like this is actually going to end quickly at all.
Yeah. That is Willem Marx. Thank you so much, Willem.
Thank you.
Each week, a well-known guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. For more than 4 decades, Weird Al Yankovic has been a hero to weirdos everywhere. And his favorite part of his job is going on tour and getting to meet those fans.
When I took on the name Weird Al, that was sort of an empowering thing. And a lot of kids have also come up to me and said how important it was to be represented in that way. And because, you know, in school, they might be considered a freak or a dork or a weirdo or somebody who just didn't fit in. And to have somebody like me to look up to basically saying, it's okay to be that way, that's meant a lot to some people.
Well, Weird Al is now heading off on his new Bigger and Weirder tour this summer. And ahead of that, he drew a card and talked with Wildcard host Rachel Martin about one of his non-musical pursuits, being a dad.
What period of your life do you often daydream about?
I would say my daughter's childhood. She's 22 now. She's just about to graduate from college. And I have to be careful talking about this because old pictures come up on your phone or your desktop and you go, oh, remember when you were 8? Remember when you were 5? And you go, yeah, Dad, I remember. I mean, we still love you now. We love you now.
I know. But that person's gone.
Yeah.
And you dumped her. Yeah.
My wife and I talk about this all the time. It would be great. My daughter's name is Nina. And we always used to say, it would be great if we had a Nina at every age living in our house, just 1 through 22, 22 Ninas. Because each one is so special and so beautiful and lovely and something just unique about every age. And it's such a sense of loss when that person becomes something else. Equally good, but you're missing the other person. You know what I mean?
I do. I know exactly what you mean. I have two kids, two boys who are 10 and 12. Mm-hmm. And same thing, except my time horizon for the nostalgia is much shorter than yours because they're younger. And also being the parent of very young children, I found to be very difficult. I love mm-hmm. them so much. They were so, so cute, but I was so, so tired all the time. So yes. I like to look at a picture that just of their cute little cherubic faces, and then I don't remember all the sleep deprivation.
Yes.
So the algorithm
just
works
the good stuff.
And that it feeds me the good stuff. Right, yeah. Exactly. But no, I completely... Completely, I know when you sit and you daydream about that, all those moments, and you're like, this is now a different person I get to know. And it just keeps going.
Yeah.
Did you always know you wanted to be a parent?
I don't know that I did, if I'm being totally honest. I hope she doesn't hear this.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know. I mean, I always thought it was a possibility, but it wasn't like I was in my 20s going, oh, I can't wait to have a kid. You know?
Yeah.
But
you got a lot going on.
But, you know, it's sort of like I've always been happy with my life. I've never been, like, lonely or felt something was missing. And I married late in life. So I went through, you know, up to my late 30s being a single man and being very happy. And then I got married and my life got exponentially better. And then I had a child and my life got even better yet. So it's all been very positive for me. And I'm, you know, I certainly wouldn't have it any other way.
Weird Al Yankovic's Bigger and Weirder tour kicks off this summer. You can watch that full interview by searching for Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:18. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Up next, Juana Summer speaks to journalist and author Ruthie Ackerman about her new book, The Mother Code, My Story of Love, Loss, and the Myths That Shape Us. And at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local stories and conversations at our website, kaxe.org. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. And we thank Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the Gigazone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and Gigazone Blast Wi-Fi, featuring Wi-Fi 6 technology to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, it's right here. The Bemidji Fire Department will give a presentation on fire safety tomorrow, 1 p.m. at the Bemidji Senior Center. And Minnesota authors Alan Eskins and Joshua Moling will speak at Minnesota North's Grand Rapids campus on Wednesday at 6 p.m. You can let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. Crossing Arts Alliance celebrates 25 years this Thursday, May 8th from 5 to 7 at an event at Passport, formerly known as Sage on Laurel in Brainerd. RSVP by stopping by Crossing Arts or online at crossingarts.org. Northwoods Habitat for Humanity has scheduled safety trainings for those interested in volunteering at a build site this summer. Sessions are Tuesday, May 13th at noon or Thursday, May 15th at 5:30 at the Bemidji Chamber Conference Room at the launch pad. Only one session is required. RSVP by Friday, May 9th by calling Northwoods Habitat for Humanity.
For NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Journalist Ruthie Ackerman grew up hearing difficult stories about her grandmother and her great-grandmother.
I come from a long line of women who abandoned their children, or at least that's what I'd been told.
And she thought those stories would dictate her future.
I decided when I was, you know, in my 20s and early 30s that I wouldn't become a mother because I thought that there must be some sort of flaw in my genetic code that would make me abandon any children I might have.
But years later, she learned not all the details she'd been told about abandonment in her family tree were true.
I had actually been basing my decisions about whether or not to mother on what I now call kind of half-truths and conjecture.
Ackerman's journey is the subject of her new book, The Mother Code. On the other side of her research about her family, Ackerman had a realization. Maybe she did want to be a mother. I asked her if she remembered when that first became clear.
What happened was I was sitting in my therapist's office, and she said to me, on a scale of 0 to 100, do you want to be a mother? And I just blurted out 55%. And she said, well, there you go. And I was like, wait, I thought I needed to be all in to be a mother. If I was going to annihilate my dreams and my identity and all of these images I had of sort of the Brady Bunch or trad wife mom, I should be all in, right? And my therapist said, why isn't 55% enough?
One of the reasons that I was immediately drawn to this book and why I wanted to talk to you is because I feel like I'm sort of at a similar point where I spent my entire life thinking, didn't want to have kids myself. And then, bam, early 30s hit where I started to question, like, what if this thing that I have told myself my entire life since I was a kid is not exactly what I want? And saying out loud that maybe I have that 55% and I want a child, there's power in it, but there's also a heaviness and frankly, a lot of scariness. And I wonder how you dealt with that moment.
Absolutely. I spent so much time wondering what's wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
I had so many friends that were in the hell yes camp, as I call it.
Mm-hmm.
And a few friends in the hell no camp when it came to kids. But I was in this middle, it sounds like you are too, in this middle limbo space of really not knowing. And going back to my great-grandmother and my grandmother, there was a lot of generational inheritance and trauma I was terrified of. I also have a half-brother who has a triple whammy of rare disorders, as I say in the book. And I just was absolutely not sure. And so this, I one of the things in my research that was, I guess, an aha moment, if I'm going to name anything, was when I realized that maternal ambivalence is the norm.
But we don't talk about it.
We don't talk about it, exactly. Maternal ambivalence is the norm, and yet we're told that people that are hell yes are the norm.
There's a moment that you talk about early in the book that I think really illustrated how much you wanted this child, you wrote that you bought a syringe and planned to try to impregnate yourself with your then-husband's sperm without him knowing, which feels like an extreme moment for you.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was really rock bottom in the book, both in the writing and in the realization once I wrote it. And that wasn't originally in the book, but my best friend knew all the stories, obviously. And she said, you have to put that moment in. Readers need to see just how desperate you were in that moment, that you would do almost anything, even going against all of your values, to try to have a child and keep this marriage intact. I didn't ultimately end up going through with it, but it was this moment sort of like, am I going to become this person?
So, Ruthie, this is a memoir, but you also spend a lot of time interrogating and investigating so many parts of the different journeys and paths that a person can take to becoming a parent. You also point at the inequities, and that's something you describe as the fertility wealth gap. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah. At the time, I didn't necessarily think about it. I spent $15,000 originally to freeze my eggs when I was 35 years old. And only in writing about it did I look back and think, wow, if I had taken that money and put it in a mutual fund by the time I was 65, I would have had $300,000. And it just got me thinking that we know that women get paid less than men. Mm-hmm. So it benefits men, young men, and society as a whole, and companies, if women wait to have children. And yet the burden of who pays for fertility preservation falls on young women alone.
And we should just note that for many young women, that initial $15,000 that you paid wouldn't be accessible either. Some people can't afford that.
Absolutely. There were storage fees on top of that. And ultimately, those eggs, none of them were viable. I had 14 eggs and none of them were viable.
Ruthie Ackerman, this book is about your long and messy journey to becoming a mother, but it's also about saying yes to yourself and the life you wanted after years of stifling your own wants in deference to others or in deference what society wanted from you. Can you talk a little bit about flipping that switch?
Yeah. I remember when I was married to my first husband, and I would go and talk to my friends and say, he doesn't want to have a baby. And my good friends would always say, but what do you want, Ruthie? And the truth is, in my book, what I discovered is realizing that I could be a self-actualized human and a mother. Mm. And I think what's interesting to me in this particular moment in time is that we're hearing from the federal government, they are trying to incentivize women to have children. And so the biggest incentive, I think, for motherhood would be a society that truly believes that women deserve and can live a good life, whether or not we decide to get married and have children.
Your daughter now is almost five. Her name is Clementine. Tell us a bit about her. What's she like?
Oh, my goodness. She's so funny. She's a little bit of the class clown, I guess. And she is so wonderful. I really feel like the things that I was worried about didn't come to fruition. I can't imagine a world without her. But that was something that came much later. So I think we do a disservice to ourselves and to all women when we say, you know, an alarm clock's going to go off or you're going to have an aha, when maybe that happens once we're already mothers. We grow into or become mothers through the act of mothering.
We've been speaking with Ruthie Ackerman. Her memoir, The Mother Code, My Story of Love, Loss, and the Myths That Shape Us, is out now. Ruthie, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 529. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Increasing clouds this evening with lows 42 to 48, then gradually clearing and sunny tomorrow, highs 62 to 68. Lows on Wednesday night in the 30s with possible frost early on Thursday morning, then sunny on Thursday with highs in the mid-60s to low 70s.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Bemidji Fire Chief Justin Sherwood is the first recipient of the new Northwest Technical College Impact Award. Impact stands for Innovation, Mastery, Progress, Achievement, Community, and Technology. The award honors individuals who fulfill those six pillars and recognizes the recipient for their association and contribution to the college. Sherwood became fire chief in 2021 and has a bachelor's degree from Bemidji State and a certificate from NTC, in addition to other degrees. A news release says he works to develop a departmental culture of accountability, excellence, and continuous improvement. He is also the Region 2 Northern Representative for the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association and has works published in firefighting magazines on mental health, leadership, organizational culture, and the evolving challenges facing today's fire services. Sherwood was presented with the award last week. He will share his experiences at the Northwest Technical College commencement on Friday. A new report from the Minnesota Farmers Union details the concerns raised by over 600 farmers and rural residents at 10 town halls hosted around the state in March and April. Three of the town halls were in northern Minnesota, in McGregor, Halleck, and Moorhead. The report, titled Voices Need to Be Heard, highlights seven key themes: tariffs and trade relationships, the farm bill, livelihoods and access to care, federal cuts, the risk to rural communities, immigration and labor, and the next generation of farmers. MFU President Gary Wordish says they hosted the town halls because people are frustrated their voices aren't being heard in D.C. and St. Paul. He says, quote, "This report speaks for people who want a fair chance to earn a living and the freedom to live their lives in rural Minnesota." Find more on Northern Minnesota Voices in the report at kaxe.org. Minnesota is cited in a new research brief that outlines the obstacles America would face in trying to reopen coal plants, an idea prioritized by the Trump administration. President Donald Trump has signed an executive order that aims to boost coal production, despite coal's shrinking presence in the energy sector. The administration says the move can help meet growing electricity demand with the emergence of data centers. But the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis predicts giving coal-fired power plants new life would be costly. The Institute's Dennis Wamsted says it doesn't make sense.
It's not an evil conspiracy to push coal out of the market. The reality is that coal is the most expensive resource, and so it is rightfully used the least or used last.
He points to Xcel Energy's Sherco facility an hour outside the Twin Cities, a coal plant being phased out and replaced with a massive solar operation. Wamsted says utilities are planning for other sources because they've proven to be reliable and less costly. Wamsted says time is another problem because of the maintenance backlog in getting coal plants back online, or in some cases, rebuilt. He says investors wouldn't be interested in waiting to get an older plant reopened, only to shut it down again because of the declining appetite for coal.
In 20 years or 30 years, that plant, which would still be relatively new, would probably be what we call a stranded asset.
Like clean energy infrastructure, Wamsted says ratepayers would be asked by utilities to cover the construction costs for increasing coal production. The difference, he says, is that sources like wind and solar are poised to stick around much longer, and they don't have the price volatility linked with fossil fuels. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. Two important holidays coincide this weekend: Mother's Day and Fishing Opener. Like every Mother's Day weekend, moms can fish free without a license Saturday and Sunday for Take a Mom Fishing Weekend. For the third year, moms can also participate in the free online Minnesota Moms Fishing Challenge. Join the Facebook group and submit a photo of each fish you catch over the weekend. Everyone who submits at least one fish photo will be entered into a random prize drawing. Governor Tim Walz will be in Cross Lake for the Governor's Fishing Opener. Listen next week for our report. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The winners of this year's Pulitzer Prizes for Journalism were announced just yesterday, and among the winners were some familiar names like The Washington Post, Reuters, ProPublica. But the local reporting award went to three journalists from the Baltimore Banner, a relatively new publication. They won for their coverage of the overdose crisis in Baltimore, stories that were done in conjunction with the New York Times. Kimi Yoshino is editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Banner and joins us now. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for being here. So I understand the Banner only started in 2022, right?
That's right. We're not even 3 years old.
Right. After only 3 years, what does it feel like to now be Pulitzer winners?
It's incredible. I said yesterday to the staff, never in my wildest dreams did I think that we would be here less than 3 years old winning a Pulitzer.
Yeah. Well, I want to give a shout out to the team because this prize was awarded to three journalists, reporter Elisa Zhu, photojournalist Jessica Gallagher, and data specialist Nick Team. They did a deep dive on the impact of the opioid crisis in the city, in particular on an older generation of Black men. Can you just talk a little bit about the process of reporting out the sprawling story, how long it took, the data they excavated?
Yeah, this was definitely not an easy project. We knew that we wanted to do it because the numbers that we were hearing of the people dying was just extraordinary. 6,000 people died in 6 years. The average number of people dying every year was triple the number of homicides. But the only issue that the city seemed to be talking about was the murder rate, many more people were dying of overdoses. In order to fully report this story, we needed to get a handle on the data. And that proved to be surprisingly difficult. The information that we were requesting was basic public information from autopsy reports, but they rejected our request. So we had to sue them. And this lawsuit, this legal battle, went on for almost 2 years.
Wow. Well, it was worth it. You know, there is so much to be said about reporters who are part of the very community that they are reporting on. That's why local journalism is so incredibly important in this country. Though, I understand you are not originally from Baltimore, right? And I understand that not all of your staff are originally from Baltimore. How much do you think residents there have accepted you as one of their local newsrooms?
This has actually been one of the joys of the Baltimore Banner. Uh-huh. The community was eager to have more local news here. And even though we aren't all local, we have many reporters who are from here, who were born here, who went to college here, who some of them worked at the Baltimore Sun. I think that the mix of outsiders and insiders is actually what the community needs. It needs people who know and understand the community, and it needs reporters who are coming in with a fresh eye and seeing things that maybe others didn't.
And also, I don't have to tell you that it is a very difficult time to be a local journalist, right? Like, newsrooms are closing across the country. You guys are about 3 years old now. You've received one of the most prestigious awards for journalism. As a newsroom, what do you feel you need to do to ensure that the Baltimore Banner can keep doing great journalism?
Yeah, this is a depressing time to be in local news. My former newsroom, the Los Angeles Times, has had numerous rounds of layoffs since I left. It's depressing out there. One of the reasons why I took this job to lead the Baltimore Banner and get it launched is because I believed that there is a way forward. There is hope for local news, and I think we're proving that. The community wants news. It hungers for it. It's pulling for us. I think that when we published a story about our win, we were flooded with dozens of emails, dozens of comments from people rooting for us. And I think this is coming at a time when the longtime newspaper here is weakening, and people want information that is credible, that's factual, and that they can trust.
That is Kimmy Yoshino, editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Banner. Thank you so much, and congrats again to you and your team.
Thank you so much for having me.
High school students from around the country are here in D.C. this week to compete in the 20th annual Poetry Out Loud National Finals. Students memorize and perform poems in a variety of styles and time periods. We asked some of this year's 55 competitors how they're preparing.
My name is Emily Porter. I'm from Logan High School in Logan County, West Virginia.
The Coming Woman by Mary Weston Fordham.
Looking at the poem, you have to dissect each section as a way to fully understand what the poet is trying to say.
Dear me, what a slow, pokey man.
Right now, I am spending my days watching myself in the mirror, watching each move that I make to make sure that the moves that I make are interpreting the poem as they need to be interpreted.
My name is Zeke Moses, and I'm a freshman at Bexley High School in Columbus, Ohio.
America, I Sing You Back by Allison Adele Hedge Koch.
To be so honest, I was never the type of person who loved poetry or appreciated poetry to the fullest. But as I've gone through this process, I've developed a newfound love of poetry.
Before America began to sing, I sung her to sleep, held her cradle board, wept her into day.
My name is Nyla Dinkins. I attend Benjamin Banneker Academic High School in Washington, D.C.
Learning to Read by Frances Ellen Watkins Harper.
I think judges really want to understand or see that you can understand the poem, and then also you can be the vessel of that information. And I think the way in which you make that poem your own is something that's really powerful for judges to see.
Our masters always tried to hide book learning from our eyes. Knowledge didn't agree with slavery. 'Twould make us all too wise.
That was Nyla Dinkins from Washington, D.C., Zeke Moses from Ohio, and Emily Porter from West Virginia. They spoke with NPR's Elizabeth Blair. The champion of Poetry Out Loud will be announced Wednesday night.
This is NPR News.
Well, it took two rounds of voting, but in the end, Germany's parliament elected conservative politician Friedrich Merz as chancellor today. It's a rocky start for the former businessman as he tries to revive Germany's economy, rebuild its military, and resurrect the country's global status. NPR's Rob Schmitz is covering this from Berlin. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Ari.
This was the first time in post-war Germany that it took two rounds of voting to elect a chancellor. Why does that matter?
Yeah, you know, I've covered Germany for years, and politics here are typically super boring and very stable, usually a sign of a healthy democracy. But today was anything but boring. When it came time to count the votes this morning, Merz and his colleagues, who are part of his incoming coalition government, were shocked to see that a handful of people in their own parties were voting against him. And like you mentioned, this has never happened in modern Germany, and that's why it's significant.
So why would politicians whose parties are entering into a governing coalition together vote against their candidate for chancellor?
Yeah, you know, first off, it's worth pointing out here that Merz's center-right conservatives and its coalition partner, the Social Democrats, hold a narrow majority in parliament, just a dozen more seats than the minimum required. And it took just 18 members among them to throw everything into disarray today. But it's also important to point out here that Friedrich Merz is not your typical German chancellor candidate. He's not known for compromising. He's more famous for his maverick approach to politics. And in the 2.5 months between February's election and today, he's made some big moves that have created political waves within his own party.
Like what? What's he done?
So he took advantage of the political makeup of the previous parliament to pass a law that exempted Germany's strict spending rules in order to build up the country's military. Several members of Merz's own party were not on board with this. I spoke with the German Marshall Fund's Suda David Wilp about this, and here's what she said.
Germans are used to conservative policy when it comes to spending, and they're worried that perhaps he's in over his head.
And Ari, that's not the only move that Merz made before he became chancellor. Merz was accused of launching a failed attempt to work with the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD, to pass a controversial migration motion that would have toughened up Germany's borders. And that angered many in parliament because they thought he was breaking a long-standing German tradition of not working with the AfD, a party that the government now considers an extremist entity, despite it being the second largest vote getter in the last election.
Well, tell us more about the role of AfD now. They're the main opposition party in Germany's parliament. What impact are they likely to have on German politics?
Well, most importantly for Merz, the AfD will likely be an obstacle. 1 in 5 German voters voted for the AfD. It's been designated by domestic intelligence as extremist, paving the way for the party to be placed under state surveillance. And because the AfD is the main opposition party in parliament now, this promises to sort of raise the temperature in the Bundestag as this new government tries to move forward with a big agenda.
So German politics may remain less boring than it used to be. NPR's
right.
Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz, thank you.
Thanks, Ari.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. You're listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Up ahead, we will hear about the Druze minority in Syria. And then Andre 3000 arrived at the Met Gala carpet last night with a baby grand piano strapped to his back. He is also releasing his second solo album, an EP called 7 Piano Sketches. At 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. And 7 o'clock, Sarah is your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Support for KAXE comes from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. And we thank Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwood since 1930. Patterson's features clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smart Wool. Patterson'sClothing.com. Increasing clouds this evening and lows 42 to 48, then clearing overnight with sunny skies tomorrow, high 62 to 68. Lows tomorrow night in the 30s with possible frost early on Thursday morning, then sunny skies and highs in the mid-60s to low 70s. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Learn how you can ensure KAXE's programming is here for the next generation of listeners by asking your financial advisor about charitable IRA distributions. For additional giving options, visit KAXE.org, click on Give. Thanks so much to everyone who supports KAXE. More news is next on People Powered KAXE.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Syria, with its ancient civilization, is one of the most diverse countries in the Middle East. One of the biggest minorities are the Druze, a religious sect that is little known outside the region. It holds reincarnation as a central belief. NPR's Jane Araf traveled to the Druze homeland in Sweida in southern Syria.
We're sitting in the home of Nawaf Nasser. He's a tall, dignified 78-year-old, regarded as a sheikh because of the devout life he's led. Sitting on a velveteen sofa, he shows us what he believes is a photo of himself before he died last time. This picture is from my previous life, he says. The creased photo shows a serious-looking young man on a white horse in front of a black stone house in a village a few miles away. Nasser believes he was a university student who died at the age of 25 in a riding accident. Almost everyone in Sweida knows someone who's believed to have been reincarnated. Sheikh Yasser Abu Fakhr, a Druze religious leader, tells us that reincarnation is a chance for those whose lives have been cut short to attain spiritual purification. We believe that in order to achieve divine justice, the soul must go through multiple stages in order to correct mistakes and follow the right path, he says. Druze believe that only people who have been murdered or are killed in accidents are reincarnated. Abu Fakhr says they're reborn instantly as newborn babies. Nasser says when he was 5 years old, he recognized a neighbor from his past life. After giving details of the family he would have had no way of knowing, he says his brothers and his daughter in his previous life accepted him as their reincarnated loved one. He says his daughter gave him the photo 25 years ago. His relatives confirm that the two had a close relationship until she died 4 years ago. Billions of people around the world believe in reincarnation. Dr. Jim Tucker, formerly a director at the University of Virginia School of Medicine, has studied thousands of cases, of some, he says.
I think they do provide decent evidence that some children have information about a life from the past.
In Syria, the Druze belief in reincarnation is part of the reason many conservative Muslims view them as heretics. Some militant groups have attacked them. We go to a village in Sweida province with a woman who believes she was previously a teenage girl who was stabbed to death. The woman is 60, from a family of professionals. She doesn't want her name or her voice used because she says some people would ridicule her belief. She says her first words to her mother and father were that they weren't her family and she wanted to go to her real home. They didn't know what to do with me, she says. She says as a child she would describe to them being stabbed to death. The house where she believes she was born in her past life has been long abandoned. We walk into rooms with arched stone ceilings. She says she remembers that it's from this room that she was sitting with the wedding guests on her wedding day, wearing a white dress and a white scarf covering her hair, and a headband made of gold coins. She was 16, and her father was forcing her to marry. She loved someone else. She escaped the house to where her boyfriend was waiting on a horse. They fled to her aunt's house. She has never looked for that house before, but she wants to now. Residents she stops in the streets try to find someone old enough to remember the place. Eventually, there's an entourage. Older men leading the way, dogs barking, geese honking, a dozen kids behind. We reach the abandoned home and she suddenly stops. She says there used to be a stone wall in the courtyard. It's where she says her eldest brother, believing she had disgraced the family, stabbed her to death. One of the neighbors confirms there was a wall and asks how she knew. She starts to cry. Her heart is pounding. She says it's as if she were back there. One neighbor, Hassan Halabi, guesses she has been reincarnated. He says she looks like his father and says they would have been cousins in her past life. We ask him if he believes it's possible the woman standing in front of him died here decades ago. Nothing is impossible, he says. Jane Araf, NPR News, Soweto, Syria.
By this point, you may have seen some of the over-the-top looks that swooshed down the Met Gala arrivals carpet last night. Billowing trains, cascading ruffles, and diamonds for days.
But even among all that high fashion, André 3000 stood out.
The man had a literal baby grand piano strapped to his back.
I need to know everything about this look.
It's just a piano.
It's just a piano.
Yeah.
But it's like, is it, like, could you play that piano right
yes,
now?
Yes, I could.
And the medium had a message. Timed with his Met Gala arrival, André 3000 dropped a surprise new EP called Seven Piano Sketches. In some ways, Seven Piano Sketches picks up where his last album, the flute-based New Blue Sun, left off.
André 3000 spoke with NPR's Rodney Carmichael about that album back in 2023.
Well, it's really funny, like, as a youngster, I associated jazz music with old people.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just being honest. Like, as a rapper, I associated jazz music with old people and elevator music. Like, because once I discovered it and got deep into it, and you loving Eric Dolphy and Coltrane and Yusef Lateef and Pharoah Sanders. Like, these are some of my favorites. And as a child, like, I'm like, whoa, they can actually say something or make me feel something without saying something.
And as the title of his new album, Seven Piano Sketches, suggests, it consists of seven improvisational solo piano pieces. With introductions at the top of each track.
Seven. I spent all.
In an Instagram post about the album, André 3000 said the recordings were mostly captured on his iPhone, which sat directly on the piano. Others were recorded on his laptop microphone.
He said the album's original title was The Best Worst Rap Album in History. Worst because there are no lyrics on it at all, but also the best because, quote, it's the freest emotionally and best I have felt personally. It's the best because it's like a palate cleanser for me.
Seven Piano Sketches from André 3000 is out now.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from RBC Wealth Management, dedicated to providing financial strategies to help navigate wealth planning and legacy building. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity. regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At Progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. And you may listen at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. Then at 7, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River. We thank the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors with brand